So anyway, it was really interesting to experience and to be in conversation with people over the last few days and their reactions to the events in Japan. And it really struck me that there was a lot of anxiety and a lot of fear around it. And some people were feeling really overwhelmed, and other people just feeling really sad and having a hard time with those things that are happening there. So I thought it'd be useful to talk a little bit about that tonight. I'm sure most, if not all of you, have seen some of the TV footage or the video footage of what happened in Japan. And it's very humbling and very amazing what so much water can do. Something that we often take for granted because, you know, our experience with water is we put our hand in it and it just seems like, you know, it doesn't do a whole lot. You know, it doesn't seem harmful as we're able to just kind of like, you know, run our hand through the water and it doesn't seem like it has so much powerful force. And yet such a massive amount can cause so much devastation. So it's difficult to imagine what it would be like if we were actually there. You know, it's one thing to see it on a video, but to just imagine, you know, there were times I was watching and I would just try to think, wow, what would it be like if I was actually there? And this was really happening here. And, you know, sometimes what happens to us when we watch these things is we lose our perspective and we get caught in the story or in the things that come up in us. And a lot of what we do in our practice is about being with, working with the difficulties that arise in our practice. You know, it's really interesting that someone was saying that what we experience, it was Carla this weekend, was saying that what we experience is what's in here and not out there. That the only way that we experience things is through our bodies, through our minds. And so how can we be mindful of what we're experiencing? To be with what we're experiencing, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, or neither. And what's our relationship to that? What's our relationship to those feelings? How do we relate to what we've been seeing or reading or hearing? What are the types of thoughts that come to our minds? Fear, anxiety, worry, sadness, grief, overwhelm. Some of these thoughts focus on the loss of what happened and of our own loss. There may also be aversion to just seeing the devastation, to something that's very horrific in our minds. What happens in our body as we're watching or hearing or reading about these things? Are we noticing if the body's contracting or the mind's contracting what's happening? Do we notice if we're proliferating thoughts around what's happening? Because it's, you know, as we've talked before, you know, we have the story of the darts or the arrows. We have an arrow, and the arrow was this earthquake and tsunami. And do we add to that by adding more story or more worry or more anxiety that doesn't need to be added? You know, what's the extra that causes us distress and grief and, as the Buddha would say, lamentation? So noticing the contraction or the agitation of the mind. We might also have thoughts of how we might help. We might have thoughts of compassion and care and concern. What happens to the body then? Do we notice what's happening? Are we noticing a quivering of the heart in response? The reaching out of wanting to help. Is there a way that we can be witness to this tragedy in a way that we can still be grounded? We can still be stable, not swept on by or swept away, not lost. Is there a way that we can see things clearly and be able to make an appropriate response rather than a reaction? You know, something so tragic like that can hit so many triggers in us because it's so large and so big. So can we notice what those are? What's coming up for us? What is capturing us? You know, sometimes we talk about what's the hook from the story. And a lot of times we think of it in a pleasant sense. You know, I'm using the analogy of having bait on a fish hook, and we're fish in the ocean, and there's these yummy things that come by and we want to bite them. But in the same way, we have these hooks that we bite into, and maybe it's, you know, fear, maybe it's the worry, the anxiety, the different things that we connect to and then we add. So Ajahn Chah, when he was alive, gave a Dhamma talk that was written down in a book called Our Real Home. And I wanted to read this to you. He said, "If your house is flooded or burnt to the ground, whatever the threat to it, let it concern only the house. If there's a flood, don't let it flood your mind. If there's a fire, don't let it burn your heart. Let it be merely the house, that which is outside of you, that is flooded or burned. Now is the time to allow the mind to let go of attachments. You've been alive a long time now. Your eyes have seen any number of forms and colors. Your ears have heard so many sounds. You've had any number of experiences. And that's all they were, experiences. You've eaten delicious foods, and all those good tastes were just good tastes, nothing more. the bad tastes were just bad tastes. That's all. If the eye sees a beautiful form, that's all it is, the beautiful form. An ugly form is just an ugly form. The ear hears an entrancing, melodious sound, and it's nothing more than that. A grating, discordant sound is simply that. The Buddha said that rich or poor, young or old, human or animal, no being in this world can maintain itself in any single state for long. Everything experiences change and deprivation. This is a fact of life about which we can do nothing to remedy. But the Buddha said that what we can do is to contemplate the body and mind, to see their impersonality, that neither of them is me or mine. They have only a provisional reality. It's like this house. It's only nominally yours. You couldn't take it with you anywhere. The same applies to your wealth, your possessions, and your family. They're yours only in name. They don't really belong to you. They belong to nature. Now, this truth doesn't apply to you alone. Everyone is in the same boat. Even the Lord Buddha and his enlightened disciples. They differed from us only in one respect, and that was their acceptance of the way things are. They saw that it could be no other way. So that sounds pretty harsh. The reality was that there was an earthquake and a tsunami, and it was a natural event, which happens from time to time around the world. It created tremendous devastation and tragedy for many beings, humans, animals, the trees that got ripped up. Doesn't diminish the tremendous pain and suffering of the Japanese people and other people that live there. But if we can open up to our reaction or response to what's happened, we can find stability within the chaos, even kindness and compassion. So I wanted to read something from a book. It's called Dharma, Color, and Culture. And it's from a diary of a woman by the name of Etta Hillesum. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. She had a diary and letters that she wrote in the last 2 years of her life. For much of that time, she was imprisoned in a Nazi concentration camp. She was gassed at Auschwitz at the age of 29. In facing the overwhelming force of a state gone berserk, there was nothing anyone could do to change the situation externally. But in opening fully to the truth of her suffering, Etty radically transformed her experience. Her voice carries immense authority, the authority of someone who repeatedly chose to embrace the enclosures imposed on her rather than escape them. Her words speak to me poignantly about opening our hearts to the truth of suffering. October 8, 1942. I am not afraid to look suffering straight in the eye. This morning I said to Jopi, it still all comes down to the same thing. Life is beautiful. And I believe in God. And I want to be there right in the thick of what people call horror and still be able to say, life is beautiful. July 3rd, 1943. The misery here is quite terrible. And yet, late at night, when the day has slunk away into the depths behind me, I often walk with a spring in my step along the barbed wire. And then, time and again, it soars straight from my heart. I can't help it. That's just the way it is, like some elementary force, a feeling that life is glorious and magnificent. July 7th, 1943. We have to rid ourselves of all preconceptions, of all slogans, of all sense of security. Find the courage to let go of everything, every standard, every conventional bulwark. Only then will life become infinitely rich and overflowing, even in the suffering it deals out to us. She also wrote, most of us in the West don't understand the art of suffering and experience a thousand fears instead. We cease to be alive, being full of fear, bitterness, hatred, and despair. God knows it's only too easy to understand why. But when we are deprived of our lives, are we really deprived of very much? We have to accept death as part of life, even the most horrible of deaths. I'm in Poland every day. I often see visions of poisonous green smoke. I am with the hungry, with the ill-treated and the dying every day. But I am also with the jasmine and with that piece of sky beyond my window. So it was really touching for me to see a video clip of a man and his daughter who had gone back to their house in Japan after the things had settled. And they found their two dogs alive. I don't know if you saw that clip, but when the earthquake hit, he had gone home to, I think, get his mother and other kids out of the house. And he didn't have time to get the dogs, but the dogs had been tied up in the yard. And so for all he knew, he figured the dogs had perished in the tsunami. And his older daughter had tried to get home before the tsunami hit to rescue the dogs. But when she got towards where they lived, she was blocked off by the police, and they were saying, you know, there's no way you can get there and get out in time. So she had to give up trying to find the dogs. And when they came back, they found that somehow the dogs had gotten free and had run upstairs to the second floor, and they had weathered the tsunami. But what was really striking to me was the man had said, you know, we haven't even considered asking to bring the dogs back to the shelter with us, because so many other people need the use of the shelter. Mm-hmm. And instead, he and his daughter have decided that they'll just keep going back every day through the rubble to go and take care of the dogs. But there was just so much compassion in his consideration of all the other people that needed the shelter, that to bring the dogs there with him, you know, he thought was too selfish. So, you know, I think often we allow our fears to really catch us up and to lead us around a little bit like, you know, a bull with a ring in its nose, and we can lead it where we want it to go. Carla Brennan on Saturday told a story about her fear of flying, which she also said was really a fear of crashing. And she said that when she looked at that fear, she saw that a lot of it was based in worry about how she would be in the moment of a crash. And our practice is to investigate our relationship with what's happening, what's actually happening in our reaction to it. You know, she realized that the fear was based on the not knowing, the feeling that she would be so overwhelmed or unable to be in control, that, you know, that was what was creating so much distress about why. So on the cushion, you know, we're looking at what are the things that have the potential to sweep us away, the fears that maybe come up, or how we create the additional anxiety around something that maybe is unknown. We get to see how our reactivity can create suffering by ruling us, by pulling us around. We often stay in emotional pain because we fear to let go into something that's unknown. You know, she talked about what would it be like to let go of that fear of flying, or rather the fear of crashing. Who would we be without that fear? We often create an identity of who we are in relation to fear and to pain. I am the one who's grieving, or I am the one who was hurt, or I am the one who's fearful. What would happen if we didn't identify with these emotions, but just allowed them to be part of the landscape of experience? Not me, not mine, just passing through. Just like storms passing in the sky. What would it be like to be free? In our practice, we learn that we can start to hold things, hold difficult emotions, difficult sensations, difficult thoughts. Little by little, it's a practice. We begin to see that when there's awareness, the awareness itself is not God. when we're aware of fear, the awareness is not here. It's not caught in fear. So the earth is not troubled by earthquakes. The ocean is not troubled by tsunamis. The sky is not troubled by the storms in it. So Carla read this poem by Wendell Berry, and I looked it up. And it's called "I Go Among Trees and Sit Still." I go among trees and sit still. All my stirring becomes quiet. Around me like circles on water. My tasks lay in their places, where I left them, asleep like cattle. Then what I am afraid of comes. I live for a while in its sight. What I fear in it leaves me, and the fear of it leaves me. It sings, and I hear its song. It doesn't mean that we can't take measures to be prepared for disaster, earthquake. But when we do so, are we doing what we do with the clarity of vision, the clarity of mind? Or are we blinded by fear and worry? Or are we blinded by tuning out because it's so terrible that we don't dare look at it? So here's another passage by Thich Nhat Hanh, and it's from the same book that I read from before. The essay is entitled "The Nobility of Suffering." You should not allow suffering to overwhelm you. But if you know how to look deeply into suffering and learn from it, then you have the wisdom of understanding and compassion. There is no lotus flower possible without the mud. There is no understanding and compassion without suffering. I would never want to send my children to a place where there is no suffering, because in such a place, they would have no chance to learn how to understand and to be compassionate. It is by touching suffering, understanding suffering, that you have a chance to understand people and their suffering. Because of your own suffering, you begin to know what it means to be compassionate. A place where there is no understanding and compassion is hell. So we can look at our own suffering in our relationship with the events in Japan, how we relate to the experience of seeing, hearing, and reading about it, whether we experience agitation or anxiety or fear. And in knowing these experiences and their felt sense in the body, how we are if we allow them to expand into more worry, more thinking, more agitation. Round and round we go. And we have more worry and more fear and more anxiety. Or how if we just allow them to be known, to be seen, and to pass through, and to know that there's a freedom or a release if we don't hold on. with this understanding, we can open to understanding the pain, the sorrow, the confusion, the suffering that's happening in Japan. When our own hearts are not contracted in fear, we can then authentically move towards compassion and a compassionate response. I know that you've heard the poem by Naomi Shihab Nye on kindness. And she says in there, you must know the depth of sorrow in order to know kindness. Bill gave a talk on the Buddhist approach to facing challenges in life, his response to what happened in Japan. And I highly recommend you listening to it. But he states in that Buddhism doesn't tell us how to be. It doesn't tell us that we have to be compassionate. But Buddhism teaches us how to open to experience. In an opening to experience, and in opening our hearts, the natural response to suffering is compassion. We can choose to respond in an appropriate way when we see things clearly, but not when we're caught. Can we notice the caughtness of our relationship? Can we notice the things that trigger our own fears as we're watching what happened? So I'm going to end with a poem. And this is anonymous. But it's called letting go. To let go doesn't mean to stop caring. It means I can't do it for someone else. To let go is not to cut myself off. It's the realization that I can't control another. To let go is not to enable, but to allow learning from natural consequences. To let go is to admit powerlessness, which means the outcome is not in my hands. To let go is not to try and change or blame another. I can only change myself. To let go is not to care for, but to care about. To let go is not to fix, but to be supportive. To let go is not to judge, but to allow another to be a human being. To let go is not to be in the middle arranging all the outcomes, but to allow others to affect their own outcomes. To let go is not to be protective. It is to permit another to face reality. To let go is not to deny, but to accept. To let go is not to nag, scold, or argue, but to search out my own shortcomings and correct them. To let go is not to adjust everything to my desires, but to take each day as it comes and cherish the moment. To let go is not to criticize and regulate anyone, but to try to become what I dream I can be. To let go is not to regret the past, but to grow and live for the future. To let go is to fear less and love more. So, I leave those words for your contemplation. I know I probably stirred up a lot of different things in the mind. This practice has, at the end of it, the idea of liberation. And sometimes some people have equated liberation with equanimity. And the Pali word for equanimity, besides upekkha, is majjhatatatta, I believe is how it's pronounced. And it means to be in the middle of. So can we be in the middle of all that is difficult and not lose our footing? To not lose our peace?
That's why it's called a practice. And that's the end of the practice. So, you know, we work with it.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Well, we have a very sick old dog at our house right now, and he's really going downhill, and I find myself kind of in and out of reaction. But there's the times when I walk by him and I see him looking very sick and I don't feel much, and other times when I stop to pet him and get more engaged. And I guess I feel like if I'm being what I interpret as equanimous of not reacting, then I'm almost being callous or being numb. And so What's the difference there?
So the near enemy of compassion is indifference. And a lot of times people will think, equanimity. A lot of times people think equanimity means, well, being completely unmoved. And it's not that you don't care, but it's that you're not creating suffering in your own mind. So there's actually a way in which you can hold compassion and you can hold care and hold love in your heart for a being that's suffering. But equanimity is the understanding that you can only do so much for that being. And if you hold on to the idea that you have to do something or that you have a certain outcome, will have suffering. So, as Ajahn Chah said, the way things are, if you're fighting against the way things are, then you're going to suffer. Okay. So, for example, if you're suffering and I see you suffering, and I offer you my hand or I offer you my presence, and you don't take it, if I'm attached to your suffering and I have an idea that I have to alleviate your suffering, I will suffer. But I can still offer you care and kindness. But if you don't take the care and kindness and you continue to suffer, that is your choice. I cannot control your choice. So not having the attachment to there has to be some outcome from my offering of care and compassion can allow me to stay grounded even when they're still suffering. Does that make sense? I don't know if that makes sense. But otherwise, what you're doing is you're attaching your happiness to the happiness of someone else. And as we all know, we don't even have control over our own happiness. Right? We can set causes and conditions so that happiness can arise. But we can't make it happen. Right? And so we have this illusion that we can make it happen for someone else. Right? But we can't. So when we struggle with that, when we think, oh, I should have done more, and we feel guilt or remorse about the way someone else is suffering, that's just suffering. That's not liberation. Doesn't mean that I don't care, but it means that I understand that I can only do so much and then there's nothing more. But my happiness doesn't depend on your suffering being alleviated. So it's complex, you know. So it's seeing the attachment. I can only be happy if your suffering abates, is a setup for failure. Okay. So like in the poem by Dana Falls, she talks about perfection is nothing more than a guarantee for suffering. Right? Because we can never achieve perfection. So we're literally saying, in the sense of, you know, seeing someone else's suffering, you know, we're kind of going, okay, I want to alleviate suffering, and I can't be happy unless all suffering is alleviated. It's impossible. So the Buddha says, look at what is the true nature. The true nature is that you don't have that kind of control. If you let go of the attachment to thinking you have control, then you won't suffer. Your heart will move in reaction to suffering. Right? So you may feel pain. You may feel sadness. Okay? So the Pali translation of the word compassion, if you take the literal translation, is the heart moving in response, or the resonance of the heart in response to suffering. So it's not that we don't experience pain. We don't experience the pain of seeing these people who are suffering. But are we adding extra arrows to the pain? Are we adding on top of it guilt, remorse, whatever, on top of just the pain? So just as like in our experience on the cushion, if a painful sensation arises and we immediately go, oh, that's bad, it means that there's something wrong with me, that's another arrow. And then when we go, well, you know, I think that's going to damage my knee and I won't be able to walk and I might need a knee replacement, and I better make an appointment to see the doctor right away. And if I don't move, I'm going to be crippled for life. That's more arrows. That's more suffering. If we only stay with the sensation and notice that sensation is unpleasant and don't pick it up and spin more thoughts around it, then that's all it is. It's just unpleasant. So what's our relationship? When we get unpleasant sensations, are we pushing it away with aversion or fear? Are we grasping at pleasure to distract ourselves from what's unpleasant. We're not free if the emotions rule us. We're not free if our thoughts rule us. So when we can step back and go, it's just like this, without giving it power, then we have the ability to step back and make an appropriate response. That answered your question. Yeah, because so often we turn off, you know, because it becomes unpleasant. We go, okay, I just won't care, and then it won't bother me. And we become indifferent. So it's not about saying, I don't care about the people in Japan. It's not about, I don't have feelings for what's happening. But it's not letting those feelings become so overwhelming that they sweep me away and they control me.
I think part of my struggle is I know that I'm caught,
mm-hmm.
And I feel for me that I don't experience the recovery time between catastrophes and disasters,
right.
All of them, starting with Katrina,
right.
And Haiti and Thailand and Chile and others, leading up to the one in Japan. I am totally overwhelmed,
yep.
with emotion. And then what concretizes the connection between people, and we're all one, is the thing that happened in Santa Cruz. And Crescent City, with the water also doing millions of dollars in damage there, and loss and loss and loss, and then trade winds, or whatever it is
that
we may be experiencing from the meltdowns in Japan. So I feel it all, and I am oftentimes about to burst. When I recognize that I'm at the edge of a panic attack, mm-hmm. I go to the yard, I do something, I distract myself. Mm-hmm. But I don't feel that I have the recovery time that's necessary between chaos to feel clear.
Yeah.
And to separate out from this happening to me, although it feels like it's happening to me personally and all those I love,
right.
and people I don't know, but I feel one with those folk. And it's a bit much to bear.
Yeah.
I'm fighting back emotion now because I need to step to the left or the right of where I am,
right.
because where I am is very important.
Right. So, you know, this practice is a gradual practice.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to say something kind of a little bit harsh at first, and then I'll explain it. But unfortunately, life doesn't come
mm-hmm.
at the rate that we would like it to be. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And things often happen, and we don't have time to regain our footing. Or we can't say, oh, can you put that off until next week when I'm feeling better? Okay? Life will come at us full force. So really this practice is so important. And this is where I see the value of this practice is in terms of finding that stability among all of the things that normally knock us over. But maybe plunging yourself into the immediate devastation and all of the graphic things that are going on maybe isn't useful for you. And so to notice, oh, you know, I'm really sensitive to this. Maybe I need to not turn the TV on or not read the newspaper for a while or not engage in that. But the core practice, and maybe it's something that you can explore, is a lot of times when the things become really overwhelming is because we let our thoughts create more reinforcement. Okay, so we feel maybe some fear or some sadness, and then we go, oh, and I'm thinking about all of those other people that are also feeling this. And so we compound, right? We add on this extra stuff. It's the darts. We're adding more and more darts. So the practice is about coming back to being in the body. And a lot of times it can be a little confusing because sometimes we talk about feeling. And sometimes we connect feeling with thinking, feeling with emotion. And instead, the practice is really about the felt sense in the body of what it's really like. Mm-hmm. So when you're feeling this sense of, wow, there's really this sense of anxiety, to notice that the stomach is contracted, that, you know, the belly is really, you know, in knots, for example, and it's staying just with the sensations, because it's the thinking that keeps the fire burning. It's the ruminating about, it's the story about that keeps it over and over again compounding.
Well, one of the things I recognized through some of the poetry and some of what you were reading was the issue of recovery time or lack of recovery time, not enough, and what have you. Is this week I also lost a friend back east, long-term friend, transition, and that triggered multiple family losses.
Yeah,
and so that's it was like an aha moment. Right. That's what this is about.
For me.
And
so notice
I got that.
Yeah.
And it's not like the deaths, you know, are. Like the last year or two, they were 4 or 5 years old.
Right.
There were many, there was like 4 or 5 family members who died, blah, 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 right after the other. And I haven't really grieved them.
Yeah. So you need to let.
I know what this is. It's grief.
Yeah.
You know, and this is. I guess it's just how to grieve.
Yeah. So you need to really be with that.
Mm-hmm.
And take care of that. So, you know, if you have the time, set aside some time and just be with the grief. Because as long as you're wanting to say, oh, not now, it'll keep coming back.
Right.
And so really you need to just go, oh, I need to take care of myself. And so that means compassion and kindness for yourself. And it also means saying, okay, I don't need to tap into the news. What I need to do is just take care of me for this moment.
Sometimes the therapist does not need you to
do. Yeah. Because we're always reaching out trying to help others, right? And so
and
this,
denying what one
feels. Yeah, and this practice, unfortunately, is about honesty to ourselves.
Or fortunately, whichever way.
Well, Gil likes to say, you know, self-knowledge is seldom a welcome thing. Right? Seldom a good thing. Because we need to really be honest. What's really happening? And can I be kind to myself? Because really, we need to be kind to ourselves before we can really extend that kindness outward.
So I've been reading a lot, reading poetry, reading that love and that, and it's somewhat soothing. I've been writing some too.
Yeah.
So I think
taking a walk.
Yeah.
You know, one of the, I was actually preparing to do a different talk for tonight, but because of all of the things, I changed it. But I had wanted to talk about the importance of space. The importance of space and silence. And how I read a report just recently that everyone is so, you know, connected by the internet and cell phones and tweets and everything else, that there's really no downtime for the mind. And when we don't give ourselves downtime, and that means even not reading, not writing, but just literally downtime where the mind has nothing else to do. If we don't do that, the mind gets overwhelmed, overloaded, and it can't process. It literally freezes up and just, you know, it's kind of like trying to hold too many things in your arms, you know, when you unload your car and you got all this stuff, and then you're trying to get the key for the door, and everything falls out of your arms because you couldn't keep it together. That's what happens in our minds, and that's why it's so important to have that space, so important to take time to meditate or just have quiet time. Go for a walk, not talking, not listening to your iPod, literally disconnecting. So allow some space to happen. Because sometimes it's just allowing yourself that space to process what all of the things that have been happening. You know, grief, for example, takes time to process, and you need to give it the space. And if you need to, you know, call up a friend and say, hey, I need to help some, you know, process some of this. I just need to talk. Mm-hmm. And then talk it out. But the idea is let it process. Let it out. Give it your care and attention.
Yeah. Standing still, being still.
Yeah.
Still, which is...
which may be hard, right?
Right. I try to fill all my time.
Yeah. Because what the filling of time is about that we don't want to be with it because it's scary or it's painful, right? It's like putting aside the, I have to clean the back of the garage, you know, I don't want to do it because it's awful. But when we do it, when we do it and we're done, it feels great, right?
Yeah, right.
But there's this initial, oh, it's this awful, dirty, icky, I don't want to do this, right? That's the same kind of thing. So it's really important because we do use distraction to keep us from being with. And that's what this practice is about, being with. Being in the middle of and holding it with kindness, with compassion.
Thank
you. Yeah. So we're over time, but I want to do a dedication of loving kindness. And if you want to chant, we'll chant afterwards so that anybody who wants to leave can leave right away. But I would like to dedicate the goodness and the merit of this practice together tonight for all of the goodness that comes from our practice together. May it be for the ease and comfort and well-being of those who were affected by the earthquake and the tsunami, and for all the people in the outlying areas that may have lost loved ones, may have been affected in other ways, and for the whole world, actually, because we're all affected by this, may we be wishing them and us ease and comfort and safety, and may we all be free and liberated, so we may be free of suffering.